Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.
Dozens of demonstrators chanting "Home is here." They arrived in Washington, D.C. yesterday after a 230-mile march that began in New York last month, walking for weeks to support DACA recipients. The Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA, program faces a big Supreme Court test this week. Oral arguments set for tomorrow. We'll dive into that in a few minutes with our legal Jessica Levinson. First, though, let's talk with one of the people who participated in that march. Mariana Magana joins me now from Washington. She's a DACA recipient from Los Angeles, and she marched the entire 230 miles. Hello.
Hello.
So what was that march like for you?
Definitely physically and mentally draining, to say the least. When I was approached, you know, and informed about, you know, whether I wanted to join this 230-mile march from New York to D.C., I kind of questioned whether that was a sacrifice that I wanted to take. But then I just thought about the sacrifice that our families have made in coming into this country, you know, leaving the known into the unknown. And I think I found my answer right away. And so the march was, you know, full 17 days of walking, many beautiful moments with other folks, other marchers. And, you know, we also encounter some hecklers here and there. Mm-hmm. But at the end of the day, our goal was to get to the Supreme Court. We made it here yesterday. And now we're just excited, anxious, and hopeful for the hearing tomorrow.
Right. So tell me more about the hecklers. What were they saying to you?
You know, the typical comments that you hear on TV. I think what's very interesting to note is that as we were marching through various states, as soon as some folks found out that it was a march about immigration, folks who were against that, right, they automatically tied the march to Trump. So just the concept of immigration alone, the comments that were yelled back at us, for example, would be like Trump 2020, build the wall, get a green card, nothing we haven't heard before, right? It's a lot of the rhetoric that was spewed by this president during his campaign, his initial campaign. It's being spewed today. But we just saw how it was very interesting that the connection right away was made with this current president.
So it was about 30 of you who walked the entire 230 miles, 18
yes.
days worth of walking. And will you all be inside the courtroom tomorrow?
I don't know exactly who will be inside. I know that some of them will be joining outside because there is a huge rally that's expected to happen with folks that are coming in from other parts of the country as well. And mainly DACA recipients to be outside and rally in support of our community.
But you'll be inside.
Yes.
And why is it important for you to be inside the courtroom tomorrow?
So I think it's very important because, you know, often the conversation around DACA revolves around the economic contributions, the success stories, the dreamer narrative. But I think at the end of the day, right, the attorneys will take lead in addressing the legal arguments and legal questions. But the judges are human. And so we hope that by having DACA recipients in the audience, the judges are also able to acknowledge and see the humanity that we have and acknowledge us as human beings first and foremost before having the conversation about economic contributions and anything else that we bring into this country.
Tell me a little bit more about you and your family. And I understand you were born in Mexico. When did you mm-hmm. come here? How old were you?
So I was born in Mexico, and I came to the United States when I was 1 year old. I was actually raised in LA County, but specifically in the city of Santa Monica. That is still my home at the moment. I went to school there. I went to college in the LA area, and I work in the LA area. And so, you know, the essential basis of this campaign is to remind folks that our home is here. My home is here in LA, and it is what I know the most and what is dear to my heart. And so I hope that we are very hopeful that the Supreme Court is on the right side of history and reminds this country that DACA folks' home is here in the United States.
So your parents came here, crossed the border illegally, right? And they are still undocumented?
So I will not be talking about my parents.
Okay. And what about your siblings?
My siblings, one is a DACA recipient and one is a U.S. citizen.
So did you, when you were growing up, did you understand your status? your immigration
I've always known I was undocumented. Obviously, I didn't understand the consequences and the legal aspects of it until I graduated from high school and saw the limitations of what it meant to not have a Social Security number. Obviously, that changed, right, when DACA was announced and I applied and obtained DACA. But I always grew up knowing about my status.
So tell me about that moment when President Obama announced DACA. It was 2012. How old were you and when did you find out about it and what did it mean for you?
When President Obama announced DACA, I had just graduated from high school. I was still 17 years old, and it was actually a day after my graduation. And I didn't really know what it meant right in that moment. I had done some work in immigration rights, specifically with undocumented students. So I was a bit cynical when I first heard about it because we had seen the DREAM Act fail in 2010. But when I realized what it was, right, and the relief that it would afford some of us for 2 years, I was excited. But at the same time, I think I was also a little heartbroken to see that it only applied to a very small portion of our community. And many, many other folks, including the 11 million undocumented folks, were not included in the DACA program.
So when you got your status, you could work, obviously. You could get a driver's license. How else did it change your life?
Well, you know, when I came to this country and growing up in this country, right, you know, a lot of the times immigrant families are just trying to have basic survival, right? You know, have food on the table, make sure that there's a roof over our head. But essentially what DACA allowed me to do is to start thriving in this country, you know, where I was able to go to college. I was able to work while in college to pay for some of my books, my tuition. But then essentially after graduating from college, I was able to apply to, you know, other sorts of programs that require Social Security numbers to expose me to other forms of opportunities that I probably would not have had I not had DACA.
So what happens if your side loses before the Supreme Court and deportation orders are basically carried out? What then?
Well, we don't know that that's going to happen, right? That's speculation that, you know, all the DACA recipients would be like rounded up and deported. Obviously, we have those conversations as to, you know, what could happen next if DHS starts, you know, to want to use that information for purposes that we did not give them that information for. But that's why it's also important for us to have those conversations with Congress and Congress members who also have some form of oversight over that agency.
So you're hoping to find some kind of more permanent, more viable solution through Congress if the courts don't rule in your favor.
Yes. Yeah.
All right. Well, it's been great speaking with you. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
That's Mariana Magana. She's a DACA recipient. She's in Washington ahead of tomorrow's Supreme Court arguments. Another DACA recipient invested in the Supreme Court decision is one of the lawyers arguing in favor of the Obama-era legislation. Luis Cortez was brought here illegally from Mexico when he was just 1 year old. He told PBS last year he feels his undocumented status the most when he's in the courtroom.
Because there are situations where I will win a case for my client, and now he's in a better position than I am walking out of that courtroom than when we both walked in there.
Now, the 31-year-old lawyer is arguing his first Supreme Court case tomorrow. With me to talk about his story is Ariane DeVogue. She covers the Supreme Court for CNN. Hi.
Hi, Madeline.
Well, tell us who he is representing.
Well, it's interesting because the case before the court, of course, is three consolidated cases. So Luis Cortez is going to be one of the co-counsel. Of course, Ted Olson is taking the lead. But together, the team is representing the individual DACA recipients, some schools, and some states that are actually in favor of the program.
All right. So he will be alongside Ted Olson. For people who don't know that name, he's pretty famous. He was President Bush's Solicitor General. He argued Bush v. Gore for Bush. That was a winning argument, obviously.
He's a fascinating choice, right?
Yeah.
He's a Republican, and he's meant to target the conservatives on the court, people like Chief Justice John Roberts. But of course, Luis Cortez is there kind of for a different reason.
What is he there for? Is he going to be making arguments?
Well, he's not making arguments, but he's going to be sitting at the lawyer's table, at the feet of the justices. He's the co-counsel. And the most important thing, obviously, is he's actually somebody who's a DACA recipient, unlike Ted Olson, for instance, who has argued all these cases, knows the justices inside out. Cortez actually has been on the ground representing some of these clients since the beginning. But more importantly for him, he knows their life story because he's lived it himself.
That is interesting. So do you expect Ted Olson to then point to his co-counsel and say, look, here is a prime example of why you should keep this program in place?
I think he might, but even if he doesn't, remember what Olson and the legal teams here are arguing. It's not whether or not DACA, the program, is illegal. It's not even whether or not the president could reverse course and terminate the program. The essence of this case is how the administration went about doing it, because you have to follow a federal law when you do something like this. And Olson's whole argument is the federal government didn't. And the reason that's important is you have to follow this law. Otherwise, it's unfair for those people who rely upon it. So that's the Dreamers. That's maybe business. That's schools. So even if he doesn't open his mouth, which he won't, the justices are going to see a living, breathing example of somebody who has participated in the program, is a lawyer at the highest echelon of the judicial system, and who would be irreparably damaged if the program went away. So it takes it away from the sort of abstract idea, and he represents sort of the specific talking point that Olson's trying to get across.
Yeah, okay, so we are going to get more into the legal arguments in our next segment with our regular legal, Jessica Levinson, but I want you to tell me more about Luis Cortez, his personal story. Where did he grow up, and how did he become a lawyer?
Well, he came to the United States at 1 year old. He came with his parents, and his father worked in the fast food industry. His mother was a housekeeper. And what's interesting about him is he didn't know right away about his status, but he slowly began to realize it. For instance, in elementary school, they were raising money, I think, for a trip abroad to Europe. Well, he suddenly found out he couldn't go. He couldn't get a driver's license. But when it really hit home is when his father attempted to come out from the shadows and to get authorization and was denied, and then he was deported. So suddenly he really felt in his family the ramifications of this. His father is deported. He has younger siblings that, of course, were born in the United States so that they are actual legal residents. So he decided he went on he's from the Bay Area. He went, graduated from college, and then he decided to go to law school. And he said he even questioned himself, like, why am I going to law school if I can't get a job afterwards? But when he was in his second year, that's when President Obama pushed through DACA. And for him, that changed everything, because suddenly he could get a Social Security number, he could get his driver's license, and he went to law school, graduated, started working for clients who were immigrants. Eventually, that led him to where he is today. So an interesting story.
Yeah, fascinating. And only, though, in 2014, so only 5 years ago, did California pass a law allowing Dreamers to become lawyers. So that's pretty unusual, right, for a Dreamer to be a lawyer?
Well, he actually went to school at the law school in Idaho. He said that he told me that it was less expensive for him to apply out of state, I guess, than to go to an in-state school. So that's where he went.
Right. But in terms of working as a lawyer in California,
he
couldn't have done that until 2014, right?
Yeah, I guess so. That's true.
Right. So I guess the big question, and he must be pondering this personally as well as for his clients. So what happens if he and Ted Olson lose their case tomorrow?
Well, what's interesting about this is that the day, if say they were to lose, that the way the program is structured, it's all about renewals. And for instance, he just recently got a renewal, and that will last for 2 years. So he wouldn't lose his work authorization till 2021. But I asked him about this, and he says that he would be saddened if he were deported for so many reasons. One, Congress wouldn't have acted afterwards, right? The president dangles that possibility that he's going to work with Congress on this. And he said the plight of the Dreamers is that they were brought here as children. Many of them don't speak the language of the country where they're from. They've never visited it. So he would basically be sent from the only country he's ever known to a completely foreign place. And that is so much like many of the other dreamers at issue here.
All right, some 700,000. Well, I want to thank you so much for joining us today.
Anytime. Thank you.
Ariane DeVogue, Supreme Court reporter for CNN. Coming up, we'll get the legal arguments, pro and con, with our very own legal, Jessica Levinson, next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Let's talk now about the arguments in the DACA case before the Supreme Court. Jessica Levinson is here to walk us through them. She's a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Monday legal. Hello.
Hello.
Well, let's begin with the White House. What are they arguing? What does President Trump say when he says, look, I have the authority to end DACA?
Well, they're arguing a lot of different things. There's actually pretty complicated number of legal claims flying up and back here. So the first thing that the Trump administration is arguing is federal judges, you have no place here. This is an administrative decision by the Department of Homeland Security. When they make policy decisions within their discretion, as opposed to legal decisions, then those are not reviewable. So the first thing that the Trump administration hopes that the judges will say is, we have no place here.
But does that mean that anything the administration does is not legally reviewable?
No. So there is a narrow kind of part of administrative law that says basically if there's an administrative agency and they're exercising their discretion to implement a policy rule, then there may be situations where that is not reviewable by judges. But if they're not exercising discretion and they're making a legal judgment, then that is reviewable by judges. So this is hurdle number one. And this is really a weird one because the Department of Homeland Security is saying, well, we really didn't have any choice. We had to end DACA because it's not legal. And then what the courts are saying is, okay, well, if you had no choice, then you didn't exercise any discretion, and therefore this is a legal judgment. And so I, as a judge, get to be here.
Then you do have the authority to review it. I get it. Okay, so what else are they arguing? That's hurdle number one.
So hurdle number one is, do the judges even get to be there at all? Then hurdle number two is, and this is Ariane actually previewed this, did the Trump administration try and end DACA in the right way? There's basically no one that doubts that the Trump administration has the power to end DACA. It was implemented by President Obama as an executive order. It wasn't intended, frankly, to live forever. It was only implemented as an executive order because Congress failed to act. And so this is where the law that Ariane talked about called the Administrative Procedures Act steps in. And the question in this case is, did the Trump administration basically do its homework? Did they act rationally? Did they have a good reason for saying we're ending DACA? Or did they act in an arbitrary and capricious manner? If this sounds familiar to your listeners, it should, because it's the same issue that was at issue in the Supreme Court dealing with whether or not a citizenship question mm-hmm. could be added to the census.
Right. And so is there any evidence that it wasn't arbitrary? Were there long paper trails, memos, research, anything that the administration is citing that said, no, we did go into this, look at it to see whether or not it was effective, how it would be carried out, any of that?
No. And that's the problem for the Trump administration. And that's why three of the three federal courts to look at this case said, no, Trump administration, one, I have a right to be here. And two, you didn't do this the right way. And so what the Trump administration did, or frankly failed to do, which is kind of befuddling to a lot of people, is they just didn't have a searching policy review. They didn't say, let's look at the pros and cons of DACA. Let's look at the economic effects of ending DACA. Let's look at the reliance interests of ending DACA. Instead, what we have is this like basically very short memo by a member of the Department of Homeland Security saying, well, Jeff Sessions told me that DACA is illegal, so I guess we can't. I guess we can't implement it anymore.
That's it.
There's a little bit more, but that's the crux of it.
Okay, so as you did mention the census case before the Supreme Court, the swing justice on that one was Justice Roberts. Is he going to be the swing on this one too?
Yes, and you can see it in the filings. Everybody has now realized they're not writing a letter to Justice Anthony Kennedy anymore, the old swing vote, because he retired. A lot of this is geared to Chief Justice John Roberts, and it's not totally blunt force in the language that the briefs use, but it's clear that they're trying to say to him, remember last June when you said that administrative agencies have to have a decent reason for doing something? Well, here we are again, and here's another administrative agency, in this case, the Department of Homeland Security, and they don't have a good reason. So stand by your word, Chief Justice John Roberts. The question is whether he's willing to go basically two for two on really high profile, controversial cases, break with the conservatives, which is, I suspect, how this will break down. It will be conservatives on one hand, liberals on the other. And where is Chief Justice John Roberts?
So basically, Ted Olson is going to try to appeal to him when he makes his arguments tomorrow. What else is Ted Olson, Luis Cortez, the people who want to keep this program in place, what else are they going to argue?
So in addition to arguing that, you know, the judges do have a role here, that the Trump administration didn't act properly under the Administrative Procedures Act, what they're going to say is, and DACA itself is legal. If you want to get there, they're going to be prepared to argue that that is a legal program. And then they're also going to say, if you ended this, you could actually illegally harm the rights of Dreamers. They have relied on this program. They have many serious economic and educational opportunities. It will affect not just them, but it will affect their families. And so they're basically ready at any moment for four different arguments. It will be really interesting to see if the justices just focus on whether or not they can even be there to review the decision, or if the justices focus almost solely on the Administrative Procedures Act, or if they actually want to get into the legality of DACA.
What about DAPA, which was a similar program which protected the parents of Dreamers? There was a 4-4 split on the court before there was an additional justice to break the tie, which basically left in place the lower court's rulings that it was illegal, right, that to get rid of the program?
Yes, and this is part of why the Trump administration is arguing that DACA stands on legally shaky grounds, because they say, look at what the Fifth Circuit said with respect to DAPA. That was a different executive order issued by President Obama. It dealt mainly with the parents of the Dreamers. It was an much more expanded version of DACA. And the Fifth Circuit said, no, this is not permissible. Of course, it went to the Supreme Court. Justice Scalia died, so there's 8 members. When the Supreme Court splits, the lower court decision stands. And that's part of what the Trump administration is using to say, well, I'm not really sure that DACA is all that legal, because look at what happened to DAPA.
Wow. And they're not going to look at that again. That's done.
DAPA will not come back up, except in this kind of play within a play tomorrow, talking about whether or not the decision about DAPA has any bearing on the legality of DACA.
Okay. All right. Quickly, I want to just make a little right turn into impeachment, because why not? It's a new, fresh week. And Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney is wanting to go to a court to get the court to tell him whether or not he needs to testify before the impeachment inquiry. What's happening?
Well, what's happening is Acting Chief of Staff Mick Mulvaney essentially not wanting to make a decision for himself. He doesn't either want to tell his boss, President Trump, the head of the executive branch, sorry, but I am going to comply with the impeachment proceedings. I am going to respond to a congressional subpoena. And he doesn't, on the other hand, want to say to Congress, I know that we're an impeachment inquiry. I know that you issued a subpoena. I know that those subpoenas are at their height during an impeachment inquiry, but I don't want to comply. So he's basically literally throwing this in somebody else's court, saying to a judge, You need to weigh these two competing branches, these two competing directives, and you have to tell me what to do.
Well, meanwhile, the other guys on this lawsuit, John Bolton and this guy Charles Kupperman, are saying, no, we don't want you, Mulvaney, to join our lawsuit. Why?
They don't. They're saying that the facts are different, that the law is different, in part because Mick Mulvaney is still part of the administration. They no longer are. I think they just don't want him there. I think that they're upset that he didn't do the normal thing, which is to ask, should I join your lawsuit? There's no normal about this. It's abnormal on top of abnormal at this point.
Sounds a little sandboxy, to be honest. A little preschool sandboxy politics. Jessica Levinson is a law professor at Loyola Law School and a regular Monday League Legal. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, why paid maternity leave is not necessarily a good thing for women. And later, Morrissey fans reassess.
This is the same man who wrote these lyrics and who can talk about and sing about racist hate in the Lone Star State and then turn right around 15 years later and endorse a party that essentially, in my view at least, is in alignment with those things he sings against.
Morrissey's Latinx fan base coming to terms with his support for a far-right anti-immigrant group in Britain. That story coming up on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. Here in California, thanks to the 2004 Paid Family Leave Act, new moms are entitled to 6 partially paid weeks of bonding time with their babies. You might think that having some paid time off would help working mothers keep up their income after having a child, but a new study examining the effect of that law found it may hurt new moms financially. The study found that they lost, on average, $24,000 in wages in the 10 years after the law took effect. Elena Patel is one of the authors of the study. She's a finance professor at the University of Utah. Welcome.
Hi, thank you.
Well, were you surprised when you got a look at your findings?
Yeah, we were surprised, I think especially by the long-term impacts, because it was such a relatively small increase for what we have in the United States. You went from only 6 to 12 weeks. So to see such persistent impacts over a decade was surprising to us.
Right. So what's the root of it? What did you find?
So we found that for new moms, they do see a decrease in wages for those moms that took up paid family leave in 2004. And we spent a lot of time puzzling over what could possibly be driving this result. Of course, advocates who are in favor of paid family leave, when they talk about it, they generally talk about the way that paid leave helps a mom stay attached to her employer. So, for example, if a mom can't stay attached and has to take time off and then look for a job, that can be costly for the firm and also costly for the mom having lost firm-specific human capital. So this is a lot of the reason why advocates champion paid family leave as something to help attachment. And we can look at this directly because we rely on tax data for our analysis, which helps you see employment to attachment to employers. And in this case, we don't see any improved attachment to employers for women. So if you put that aside, we tried to think about what could be driving lower wages for these mothers in California in 2004. And what we fixate on are the clues in the tax data that can help us think about this. So there's two channels. It could be that employers are discriminating against new moms, and of course we would worry about that. And so they might be less likely to hire and promote women if women are more costly employees compared to men with paid leave. And this is a little bit the criticism about paid family leave policies. You might be concerned about this discrimination. At the same time, moms can choose to opt out. And both of these are going to have a negative impact on wages when you look at all mothers, whether they're being discriminated against or whether they choose to opt out. And what we try to do is disentangle which of these is likely to be the driving force for the decrease in wages. So our evidence suggests that it's more likely that moms are opting out because the impact that we see, the depression in wages, is for new moms. So for moms who had a first birth in 2004 compared to moms who had a second, third, or fourth child in 2004. And that suggests that it's unlikely that employer discrimination is really driving the negative wage result. It's hard to imagine that employers are discriminating against new moms differentially from moms that already have children. and makes it more likely that it's probably that moms are opting out of the labor force. And then the tax data have other clues about this as well. Opting out doesn't necessarily mean you fully separate. It could just mean that you switch to part-time employment, which would look like reduced wages in the tax data. It could be that moms are looking for more flexible work options, and we do see evidence in the tax data that new mothers are more likely to be self-employed after paid family leave. And all of these things are going to look like a decrease in wages, but actually reflect moms sort of looking for more flexible work after they've had a child.
And they have the cushion to do so because they've got some money coming in. Is that
so? Yeah,
is that
for
the idea?
Up to 12 weeks. Yep, so for up to 12 weeks after the birth. The first 6 weeks is covered by a law that was pre-existing in California. The short-term disability insurance program provides 6 weeks of leave, and then after the passage of paid family leave, moms get an extra 6 weeks. So those 12 weeks are the paid leave that moms can take post-birth.
Okay, but so they might feel, okay, I've got 12 weeks of partially paid leave. I can maybe not return to work as quickly or as fully because I've got this money, and during that time off, maybe I'll be looking for other work.
Or it could be that moms sort of are just, I think that the channel that this is driven by for new moms, that there's something very intuitive going on about how well you're able to bond with your child in the first 12 weeks, 18 weeks, 20 weeks after birth. And we think that the extra 6 weeks at home between 6 and 12 weeks is really improving the relationship and well-being of mothers and their children, and that it's this experience that's driving moms to potentially work a little bit less, seek more flexible arrangement, and other things that would manifest into lower wages. So we use census data to think about this question because the tax data aren't really well suited to answer sort of bonding between mothers and children. But in the census, we see evidence that for these moms that first had access to paid leave, they are more likely to eat breakfast with their kids, to take them on outings, and to read with them, which is all really consistent with this notion of the extra 6 weeks at home is really improving the relationship and bonding between mother and child.
But what about dads? Did you study dads? Because it's paid family leave. So
yep.
Dads can take
it too. So we did look at dads. That's right. So dads, there's no gender restrictions written into the law as it stands. But the truth is that despite being a gender neutral policy, dads are much less likely to take up the policy, especially in 2004. So for moms, it was about 20% take up. But for dads, it was more like 3 or 4%. So we do study the impact on dads of paid family leave, but in light of the low take-up, it's perhaps not surprising that we don't really see any impact of paid family leave on employment or attachment or wages. There's just no result there for dads.
And one of your conclusions was also surprising, that paid leave led women to have fewer children. First of all, how did you make that connection, and why was it?
So the tax data can be linked with the Social Security data. So for all these women that had access to paid leave in 2004, we can follow them and their fertility for 10 years going forward. We do see a small decrease in the number of children born. That's consistent, again, with this notion of if you increase the quality of relationship that you have with your children, economics would suggest that you would reduce the quantity of children that you have. And so this is all really consistent with this notion of mothers are having higher quality relationships with their children as a result of the paid family leave.
Why would you have fewer children if you have higher quality connections?
It sort of increases the cost of parenting. So if you're putting more effort into the children that you have, you're less likely to have more children.
Because it just costs more to have more?
It's just more costly. And I don't necessarily mean dollars spent, just the sort of investment that you make in your relationship with your children.
So what is your conclusion after going through these findings when it comes to paid family leave? Because here in California, the governor is proposing expanding it.
So I think it's important to keep in mind what the policy goal is. I think that paid family leave has been billed as a silver bullet to help women stay attached to the labor force. The evidence in California is not consistent with this, but I'm not sure that that should be the policy goal. We do see positive impacts on moms and their relationship with kids. And if you view the $24,000 as an investment in your children rather than a reduction in wages, this could still be a policy that's achieving what California is setting out to achieve. Certainly, this is something that is looked at in Europe as well, where there are more pervasive and much more generous paid leave policies than exist in the United States. And the policy goal there is not singularly focused on women's attachment to the labor force. It's focused on family and well-being. And from that perspective, I don't think California has missed the mark. I just think it's important to keep in mind what you're trying to do with these policies.
Elena Patel teaches finance at the University of Utah. Thank you.
Thank you.
Coming up, the Morrissey problem for Latinx fans. That's next on Press Play. This is Press Play on KCRW. I'm Madeline Brand. I would go out tonight, but I haven't got a stitch to wear. This man said it's gruesome that someone so handsome should care. Morrissey, somewhat of a god here in Los Angeles. So much so that yesterday, November 10th, has been dubbed Morrissey Day here in L.A. The singer lived here for a long time. He wrote lots of songs about L.A. And L.A.'s Latinx community welcomed the star with open hearts and fierce loyalty from the 80s till now. There are Morrissey karaoke nights in Boyle Heights, a cover band named Mexrissey. But for some, that loyalty is wavering now after Morrissey made some questionable statements about race, such as, quote, "everyone prefers their own race." And his increasingly outspoken support for a party, a political party called For Britain. It's in England. It's a far-right anti-Islam political party. Well, joining me to talk about all of this is Melissa Hidalgo. She wrote a book about Morrissey's Latinx fan base. It's called Moslandia, Morrissey Fans in the Borderlands. Hi there.
Hello.
Thanks for coming in.
Thank you for having me here.
Okay, so let's talk about this controversy, because one of those key moments was when he was on Jimmy Fallon, right? Mm-hmm. And he was wearing this For Britain pin. Mm-hmm. What was the reaction amongst the fans?
My sense is that this is probably the first time that a lot of fans in the U.S. got wind of what this party meant. And it was a very tiny lapel pin. You know, you could mm-hmm. barely see it. And there were Eagle Eye fans on Instagram that circled it and pointed it out. Uh-huh. You know, I'm not sure how fans reacted immediately, because I'm not sure if a lot of fans here in the States or in L.A. even know or understand what For Britain is and was.
They probably
thought,
he's just for his country.
Yeah, he's being for Morrissey. Why not? You know, and, you know, we're for America, right? So there's a sense that maybe it, you know, it was benign, or maybe Morrissey's just being Morrissey again and, you know, wanting to be controversial or something. Except that by the time, for me, since I've been researching this for quite a bit, I had already gotten wind of For Britain a year before, in April of 2018, when he actually went on his website to endorse the party. Mm. And that's when my stomach just dropped. You know?
Really?
Because I actually went to the For Britain website at that time. And when I saw the website and I did the clicking around, then it went from my stomach to just my heart, like, oh, man, this looks too familiar to me right now in
because
this country.
What did you see on that website? What are their platforms?
The stated platforms, the first stated platform is anti-Islamification or Islamization of Britain. The other platforms are things like end mass migration, secure our borders, return to the rule of law, an anti-kind of gender propaganda teaching in the schools.
Well, for that latter
yeah.
thing is really interesting for Morrissey, because he has proclaimed that he is, what, gender fluid, mm-hmm. or he hasn't said that, you know, what he prefers or who he is, right?
Yeah, and for that reason, for many years, my sense that this is the reason why so many of the fans are sort of queer or, you know,
yeah.
identify as other than normative, because of the lyrics and the music that he has sung about for many decades now. And that part about the gender is buried. Oh, it is so buried into the website. You have to click and click and click, and then you have to bother reading through these manifestos to find that. And I did, because I wanted to be sure that I knew what I was talking about. And I also wanted to be real. I wanted to see with my own eyes, is this really what this party stands for? And it does. And when I say it sounded too familiar to me, living in Trump's America that we do right now in 2019, when you look at the MAGA websites and the MAGA platforms, there is a whole lot of overlap there, right?
So he played a bunch of concerts recently here. He was at the Hollywood Bowl.
And in Irvine a few weeks
before
that.
And they were practically sold out, if mm-hmm. not sold out.
Oh, yeah.
So it doesn't seem to be affecting the fan base here.
Yeah, I mean, I didn't go, so I can't speak to either of those shows. I'm in my own kind of mourning period right now. I've pressed pause on Moz for a moment, because I really do have to sit and think through this stuff, and it's affecting me that much. Maybe a lot of fans it doesn't, you know, it's hard to speak to that, because the numbers will say, you know, the fans haven't been affected because they're still showing up. You know, Hollywood Bowl had almost 18,000 people there, and that could very well be the case. I also know, just based on private messages I've received, emails I've gotten, that I think that there are a lot more fans struggling with it privately than they care to express publicly. Mm. So that's something that I've noticed.
Well, let's go back to the origins. Mm-hmm. He was, of course, with the Smiths, formed in the early 80s. And here is a little bit from a song listeners will probably recognize.
So, I still love that music.
It's a good song.
It's beautiful.
So there is your conundrum right there.
There it is. I mean, I still get goosebumps. You know, on the way over here, I was thinking about songs like Lucky Lisp and mm-hmm. songs that still to this day, like, you know, I have a visceral reaction, but in the best way. You know, I'm not feeling gross yet, you know, and yet there it is, because the gross part comes when I really look at what he's saying in person, and I look at these political platforms. And I'd have that visceral reaction, but in another way. And that's the conundrum. That's the struggle that I'm in right now, that I know a lot of fans are in right now, because those kinds of policies, even though they are sort of contextualized or speaking quite literally just for Britain, it's the nationalist ideologies, yeah. right? It's the rhetoric around closing borders and ending migration that, you know, it resonates here in the borderlands. You know, we are in the borderlands. Mm. And this is why it matters so much to me. And to a lot of fans in this region.
Well, also what's so fascinating about this is his deep love of Los Angeles that mm-hmm. he has cultivated over the years. He's written songs about Los Angeles. In yeah. fact, let's hear a clip from one of those songs. It's called Glamorous Glue. I used to dream and I used to vow. London is dead.
London is dead. That was 92, I think, Glamorous Glue. And yeah. that would have been right around the time that Los Angeles was sort of rising as its own distinct thing, apart from sort of Smith's fandom, right? So if the Smiths were sort of already here in our airwaves, like through K-Rock and maybe our uncles or aunts, I'm in my mid-40s, so probably like an aunt or something. And me in high school kind of listening to the Smiths, right? That's where the love starts, because of that voice and those lyrics. And then he goes solo. He goes solo and he really kind of announces himself as a solo artist here in LA. And I think that that's really the moment. It was in the early 90s when he has his touring band. They're very rockabilly style, right? Mm-hmm. Those very good looking London boys with those pompadours, and yeah. they're playing the upright
You're
bass.
You're rocking a little bit of a pompadour right now.
A little bit, a little demi-pomp, I guess, a little half. I can't ever get rid of it, you know, because, you know, the other thing to realize is that Morrissey brought a kind of style, right? The rockabilly style. It's not his. It doesn't belong to him, but he made it popular with us because we recognize it as Ritchie Valens hair or as Elvis hair or as James Dean, right? And there was a big rockabilly kind of revival in the early 90s as well that he really played into. And I really think that that was one of the moments that kind of solidified his kind of LA Latinx Latino, at the time Latino Latina, because we didn't even use that term back then, but really sort of speaking to fans here really was, I think, stylistically, musically.
So flesh that a little bit more about the connection between the Latinx community and Morrissey.
Yeah, I mean, the book I wrote really was about trying to flesh it out and to sort of make sense of it in a way that was more just about why Mexicans like Morrissey, because like a lot of questions, it really isn't just one why. I think the connection to LA really is about the fact that he started his career here. He found his fan base here that kind of stuck with him. He was also just leaving England after the other members of the Smiths were trying mm-hmm. to sue him. And I really think that once he kind of affixed himself in LA or established himself in Los Angeles, you know, he goes on to the Johnny Carson show. He tours, he plays at Capitol Records for Live on K-Rock. He, you know, and then he records his so-called comeback album in 2004 called You Are the Quarry. This is after the 1990, you know, so I'm jumping back and forth, but there's a good 10 years there, I think, where he's really developing these fan bases because of a tour like Oye Esteban, which is the first time he goes to tour in Latin America and Mexico in 1990s. And so here is where the late 1990s, early 1990s, up till about Quarry in about 2000 is where you really start to see the proliferation of tribute bands, of course, starting with the first and the best one, right? Sweet and Tender Hooligans. And then right after Quarry, you see a cropping up of other fans that are wanting to get up there too. The karaoke starts at Morrissey Oki in Boyle Heights in like 2010 or 11. Mm. So you start to see just a proliferation of fan expression, you know, about Moz and what his lyrics and his music has meant to us as outsiders, as children of immigrants, as people who are struggling with Catholicism, right? All of these things that I think thematically are in there somewhere.
Let's play another one. This one's called First of the Gang to Die.
Los Angeles, you are too loud.
Los Angeles, you are too hot, he says.
Absolutely. And this is, I think, the peak of, like, peak Los Angeles here. You know,
so that's 2004.
This is 2004. And so then he comes back to the Hollywood Bowl to play in 07. And I went to that show. And, you know, you can just tell that, man, he's home. You know, he had the fans screaming. He opens up with Queen is Dead, you know, and it was the best thing in the world to see that. So he's really writing, I think, this kind of, you know, the L.A. album is often what I heard Corey called, right? He recorded it here. A lot of L.A. musicians he used. L.A., You Are Too Hot, singing about a Latino gang member called Hector. That's my father's name, you know? I'm like, oh my gosh, you know? Like, so these are all these connections. Here is where I think Morrissey's starting to kind of speak back to us, his brown fans, right? Sort of L.A. fans recognizing us. And, you know, as far as like the kind of 2004 post-Corey moment is when you start to have even more of an expression. Now you have theater, you know, you have Teatro Moz that's happening in Boyle Heights, where you have, you know, tribute bands are enough anymore. Singing karaoke isn't enough. We have to, you know, it's almost like taking it to the next level, right? There was a Morrissey poetry night and all of this stuff I wrote about. And it was beautiful material. It was beautiful expressions of fandom.
I want to play a clip of tape. He rarely gives interviews.
Yeah,
but he did back in 2015 with Larry King, of all people. So here is his first in-person interview in a decade. And Larry asked him about his popularity in Mexico. And here's what he said.
Yeah, your fame is spread. Like, for example, I understand that you're very big in Mexico.
Yes.
Why Mexico, do you think?
I don't know. It's a beautiful thing. I don't know why. I think it's the passion in the music. And
have you performed there a lot?
People, yes. They're very passionate people. And they like to hear about reality, and here I am.
Always been outspoken?
No, I'm not outspoken at all. I'm really not.
You're strongly opinionated.
Well, I'm just an ordinary person in many ways. I just speak the words of ordinary people.
Okay.
Oh, yes. Okay.
Well, it sounds like he's not really aware, you know, how big he is, but maybe he's downplaying it a little bit.
It's definitely an ineffable thing. You know, I think he writes in his autobiography a lot about his new Latino hearts, right? So almost as a way to tell, he calls the people in Britain like persnickety know-it-alls or know-nothings or something along that line. So it's almost like he's holding up his fans' ears like, see, I still have fans. I still, you know, they still love me here.
Here is a song from 2004. He released it. It's called Mexico.
If you're rich and you're white, you think you're so right. I just don't see why this should be so. In Mexico, I lay on the grass. And I cried my heart out for want of my love.
That's beautiful.
It's a beautiful song. And then when I hear that, it's very hard for me to reconcile that this is the same man who wrote these lyrics and who can talk about and sing about racist hate in the Lone Star State. And then turn right around 15 years later and endorse a party that essentially, in my view at least, and based in my research and my scholarship, is in alignment with those things he sings against in a song like Mexico. So I think that's a perfect representation of the kind of conundrum that I and many fans are in right now around, like, what is this kind of dissonance happening? You know, how can this be the same person?
Well, I wonder, while that's happening with you and other fans, if he's gaining new fans from the far right.
You know, and from what I've seen online, it certainly looks to be the case with at least some of the retweets. And again, social media, we all know, too, is kind of distorted and, you know, it kind of brings out maybe the best and the worst of people. But, you know, when you have a Milo Yiannopoulos kind of posting support, like, yes, Morrissey, and that is the case. I've seen kind of far-right fans sort of saying, you know, good for you, good for him for finally saying this kind of stuff. And that's where, you know, I don't know if I want to go to a show if those people were to show up kind of thing, you know. And that's, again, where my safety is concerned is just, you know, in my body as a queer person. There was a time where I felt really safe and really good in these fan spaces. And while Los Angeles is still very special and still very brown and still very queer in so many ways, and there's all kinds of pop culture that attest to that, there's still a bit of hesitance on my part.
That is really a shame.
It is. And I know I'll get over it someday. You know, I press pause now.
Maybe
he'll
get over it.
You know, that would be the question, right? Because at that point, it's you know, you can only ask so much of fans. And, you know, I think that there are limits to fandom. Like any relationship, I think you have to reassess it sometimes when there's problems or when something comes up. So that's kind of what I'm thinking about it, too, in those terms.
Well, no, thank you so much for coming in today.
Thank you, Madeline Brand. What an honor to be here.
What an honor to have you. Melissa Hidalgo, Morrissey expert and author of the book Moslandia, Morrissey Fans in the Borderlands.
I'm so sorry. I'm so sorry.
And that'll do it for us today at Press Play. Thanks so much for listening. I'm Madeline Brand. I'll see you tomorrow.
Oh, why do you come?
Support comes from USC Online, providing exceptional online graduate programs, certificates, and upskilling for current and aspiring professionals. Explore your graduate options today with the University of Southern California at online.usc.edu.